Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the generational trauma of the Holocaust. We talk with the author of a book tracking the lives of 10 survivors with ties to Jacksonville, along with two local descendants of Holocaust survivors. Later in the program, historian Wayne Woods schools us on how the city narrowly saved the mid-century masterpiece that once served as the main library. But first, the stories of 10 people connected by the horrors of Nazi atrocities and their lives here on the First Coast. They're the subject of I Will Give Them an Everlasting Name, Jacksonville Stories of the Holocaust, a book by my guest, author Sam Cox. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Sam Rogozinski, a local business executive whose parents survived the Holocaust. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Naomi Chase, writer and Holocaust educator, also a child of survivors. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you.
Sam, the stories in your book connect people that might not otherwise have been connected. They all ended up here in Jacksonville. How significant is their destination to the arc of this story and ultimately the story of their lives?
Well, all 10 have very unique stories. 8 of them, survivors from various places in Europe. One of them, a Danish righteous Gentile who helped save and rescue hundreds of Danish Jews during the Holocaust. And a 10th one that liberated Dachau, one of the liberators, and then stayed in Germany after the war as the assistant commandant of the prison that housed the Nazi war criminals, and he was in charge of the executioners. And so they all have radically different stories, but ultimately landed in Jacksonville after the war.
And you are a former teacher here in the First Coast. You taught in Orange Park. How did you come to meet these 10 people?
I came to Orange Park, to St. John's Country Day School in 1993. Studied modern European history before that, and the school wanted me to implement a Holocaust studies elective class for high school juniors and seniors. So I did that after my first year and taught that class for 5 years, from 94 to 99. And being new to Jacksonville and not being Jewish myself, was not really plugged into the Jewish community, but wanted to have survivors speak to my class, where it was not just in the third person, but to really have those primary sources with survivors. I was introduced to a fella at another high school, John Iori, who had been teaching at Episcopal School, a Holocaust class. And the first person he introduced me to was Ella Rogozinski, and several other survivors that had spoken to his classes. And so Ella was the first speaker I had in the fall of 94, and had several more speakers, but it's a pretty tight-knit group. It was, certainly then, and they introduced me to others, and it kind of expanded the network, and ultimately I had about 24 people speak to my class, and I just selected 10 of them to write about 25 years later.
Mm-hmm. And Sam, Ella was your mother.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about her story and your father's story, how they came to Jacksonville.
Interesting story. They're both survivors, two different parts of the world, one from Czechoslovakia, one's from Poland. My dad was one of 7. He had a brother who ended up surviving because he had gone to Russia. And then my mom had 2 sisters and a brother. 2 sisters did survive. They never let anybody in the camp know that they were siblings. my dad found out he had a surviving brother in a displaced persons camp when they were liberated at the end of the war, and decided that he's going to go find his brother in Israel. And so after a brief romance, getting married, and they go to Israel and find his brother. And then my mom, having lived, she was very young. She was 11 years younger than my dad. So she was a teenager through the Holocaust. And she goes to Israel with my father. Israel's becoming a state in 1948. You know, he's in the army. They've conscripted his truck, and he goes with his truck and goes to battle every day. And my mom has 2 sisters. At that time, Jackson was taking immigrants. And Jacksonville said, hey, we're taking Jewish immigrants. Come to Jacksonville. So her 2 sisters were here already. She comes to visit them and decides that, you know, she's known nothing but war and fighting her whole life. And my dad's back in the Army again and decides, you know what, we're going to America. She kind of wires back to my dad and said, my two brothers were born there, and says, you know what, bring the boys. This is what we're going to do now. We're going to live in America.
You were born here.
I was born here.
And you have now a very large family.
We do. We do. Between my brothers and I, we have 11 kids and, I don't know, 15, 20 grandchildren, things like that.
How much of your parents' story were you exposed to as a young child? Was it always something that you were aware of?
Always something we were aware of, obviously, with tattoos on your parents' arms.
They both had tattoos?
My dad did not have a tattoo, but my mom did. But he did have, obviously, a prisoner number, which I wear proudly every day. But we knew about the Holocaust. We knew, as young children, they didn't want to tell us about the horrendous atrocities. I think actually when Sam started to have her speak in his class is when we were older adults at that point and started to get more detail. She never really spoke about it or spoke publicly, you know, about it, other than somebody would ask about the tattoo on her arm or something like that. But their childhood, she didn't go through the atrocities other than knowing that, you know, obviously mom and dad were in the Holocaust and it was very difficult and we lost tons of family members. But it wasn't until I was a much older adult than when she started to speak in the community and listen to her speak and just realize the tragic events that she had gone through her young life.
And so that was sort of news to you late in life, kind of the specifics of what
she... right, about the death camps and the death marches and, you know, having to brutally, you know, cut off her sister's toes through from being frostbitten or, you know, the different camps that she was in.
How did that impact you at that later stage in your life to learn those awful details?
Well, it's just tragic to think of, you know, your mom, for one thing, just knowing that at that point, my mom, somebody put a tattoo on her that she didn't want. Actually, you know, our kids at one point said, you know, Dad, can we do this? Can we get a tattoo too? And my mom was like, no, and somebody forced this upon me. You're not going to do that. And it was difficult to think that somebody could do such tragic things to your mom or your dad. And it was hard to listen to these horrific stories.
Naomi, you are a Holocaust educator. Explain to us what that means. What does that entail?
Well, I was a Jewish educator.
Okay.
Over 40 years. And so I taught Torah, Hebrew, and Israel, Jewish history. My mother was raised a Reform Jew, and that's the congregation that we grew up in. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. Our father played very little role in our Jewish education. He was, in general, he was a very morose, silent man, having survived the Holocaust. So we didn't know his story. Our mother gave it to us in bits and pieces as we aged. And I was in religious school and Hebrew school as a youngster in the 60s, and Holocaust education was pretty graphic. They didn't really spare us any of the details. So I learned more about what happened during World War II from those classes and courses than I did from my actual father. But my dedication, my compulsion, my inspiration to become a Jewish educator was both because of my father's experience and to make sure that that was not the only thing that identified me as a Jew.
Explain that a little bit more.
So there's so much about Judaism that is rich and beautiful and compassionate and values-driven and humanistic. And the Holocaust stands in contrast to that. So I always understood, both because of my teachers and my mother's family's experience, that it's a choice. You can be cruel and bitter and angry and vengeful, or you can continue to believe in humanity's best. And I wanted to believe in humanity's best and wanted other Jewish kids to do that too.
And you talk about, you know, your father's affect because of what he experienced in terms of being morose and kind of silent. How did that and his experience impact you? We've talked a little bit about generational trauma, but explain how that works a little bit for people who aren't familiar.
So I imagine my mother used to say to us, and I don't remember at what age, to my sisters and me, "You are the proof that Hitler failed." So on the one hand, that's an enormous burden. And it's part of what I rejected it a little bit, because I didn't want that to be how I was defined, you know, that my father should have died. He was the only survivor of his family. On the other hand, it was, I owed him something. He can't have survived for nothing. So, and this I have realized is a shared experience of many survivors' children. We had to be the best. We had to be the most. We could not fail. We could not disappoint. And the flip side of that is, I'm not an analyst, but the flip side of that is that any trial or tribulation or pain or emotional trauma we personally experienced paled by comparison to what he had gone through.
Which is a very different kind of burden.
Right.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the impacts of survivors of the Holocaust, the generational trauma that that has left, and also the stories that the survivors have shared in a new book by author Sam Cox. You were saying that it was important to you, Sam, to have first-person sources, primary sources, talk to your students. I think we intuitively understand that that's important, but why did you want to make that a core part of your curriculum?
The Holocaust was both unique and not unique. You know, we have many examples throughout history of the inhumanity of man and people groups that are victims, and certainly culminating in the Holocaust to a large degree. And as a history teacher and historian, I really wanted to teach the next generation that these things cannot exist, and that people need to live together and out of respect and love and harmony, and they need to be aware of their past. And you know, regrettably, we are in an age today that I think it's still important that we remember that past.
So how did they receive the speakers, your students?
In incredible ways. My class was typically about 20 students, but whenever a speaker would come in, I would have faculty and staff and students from other classes come in. And so my classroom that could accommodate 20 or 25, I would have 50 or 60 people. So they would be standing. We would video the testimonies. And most of these survivors that would speak, including Sam's mother, Ella, were teenagers when they were in the camps or whatever situation they were in the Holocaust. So they were the same age as these students they were speaking to. So that really hit home that much more when the students realized, oh, they were 16, mm-hmm. they were 17, they were 18, they were my age when this was happening to them. And to have those first-person accounts, it was powerful and well-received. In fact, being back in town, I live in North Carolina now. I left Jacksonville in 1999. I have quite a few former students that are now 38, 40, 45 years old that are coming, buying the book and coming to book signings that I'm having this weekend because they say it was one of the most impactful experiences of their life.
Oh, that's extraordinary. Yeah, we should say you're in town to do a couple of book signings. You're going to be doing one Saturday at San Marco Books and More. You're going to be doing one Sunday at
Happy Medium.
I'm sorry. Yes. Kind of blanking on the name there. A lot of these people, Sam, are no longer with us. Your mother is still alive.
Yes, she is.
How did your relationship change with her after you learned more, or with your father, after you learned more about what they specifically had endured, or did it?
No, always had a wonderful relationship, very warm, loving home. But just to realize, like I said, the atrocities and things that they did go through, and really they could raise a family and have a normal childhood. I'll touch upon what Naomi said about the guilt, though. The family unit was extremely important. As it was always, you know, take care of your brothers, take care of your brothers. And here today, you know, many, many years later, us three brothers are still, you know, together, working together. And
tell, for people who don't know your name, talk about the business that you share with your brothers and kind of how that ran as a family business.
Right. So I'm the chief operating officer of the Regensburg Orthopedic Clinic. It was started by my oldest brother, Chaim Regensburg, and then my other brother, Abe, joined, and then I joined as well.
And Abe and Chaim were the two that were actually born abroad.
They were born abroad, correct. Mm-hmm. I was born here. And in the late 80s, I joined them as well. And today we have my three nephews as well who are part of the clinic. So there's now five orthopedic surgeons at the Regensburg Orthopedic Clinic. And it's still a family unit, still independently owned. And very, very proud of the fact that give my parents tons of credit for that, you know. Family, 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 take care of yourself, be together, you know, don't disappoint and, you know, do the right thing.
I think I read that you used to have board meetings at breakfast time with your mom every day.
She used to make breakfast for us every morning and we would be there early in the morning and she would have a wonderful laid out breakfast for us every day. And
this is when you're as adults heading to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Until, you know, until she was probably 85, 86 years old, she made breakfast for us in the mornings, and it was a wonderful thing, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, as Naomi said, this sense of obligation to live up to your full potential, to kind of carry on your parents.
Absolutely. Like I say, you didn't want to disappoint them. You realized as a child, they did have a rough life, and you just didn't want to do anything to upset them.
Mm-hmm. Did that feel burdensome? Did that feel like aspirational?
Yes, it is. It is. It was a burden. I mean, you know, other kids were maybe doing something they shouldn't be doing, and you kind of wanted to join along sometimes, and you, back of your head, you had that guilt, and you, I better not do that because if, you know, I upset them, they're not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. And another point she was saying as well, they told my mom after the war she wouldn't be able to have children. There's all the horrendous things her body had to go through, starvation and all these sorts of things. And they told her she'd never have children. So it was obviously a blessing for her to be able to have, you know, three kids.
She had three kids altogether?
Yeah, me and my two brothers, correct.
Okay. Naomi, I want to talk. I know you say you're a Jewish educator. We're talking, you know, rather specifically today about the Holocaust. But it has become more accepted in mandated education, including in Florida, where classes are required to be taught. This is, I looked it up, it was 2020. It was originally acted in 1994, but it sounds like it was updated in 2020 with some significance. This is at a time when we've seen a spike in anti-Semitism here in Florida, certainly. You know, we've seen Nazis at Disney World. We've seen projections of, you know, symbols on buildings here in Jacksonville. How do those two things square if we're seeing, you know, more awareness, more education, mandated education about this awful event, and at the same time, a lack of sensitivity and growing hatred in some spheres?
I can't begin to explain why it happens. You know, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it, and we've repeated it and repeated it. As Sam said, you know, ours is not the only experience of genocide. It's easy to blame the failure of education to make people aware. It's also easy to understand why people tend to downplay the horror of it. It's hard. It's hard to teach. It's hard to learn. But I don't think denying it is ever the answer. Of any traumatic experience, you have to know. You know, the rationale that it's upsetting to students or that it makes them feel that they are somehow to blame. I worry more if they don't care, if they are not moved by the stories. That to me sounds like they're inured to human suffering. And I don't know. I don't know how that happens. If there is a sense that Jews have overstated their case and been too self-advocating I imagine that Jews, among others, are part of the campaign to make it a mandated topic. But it can't be the only impetus. And I wonder if other people who have experienced trauma simply haven't had the representation, haven't had the advocacy, to make sure that the world knows the truth. Again, firsthand accounts, really compelling evidence-driven explorations of these events. But I have to also say that as a Jewish educator, it was always a part of our curriculum. So we taught it to our own children. My father didn't. My father was not very forthcoming with his story. As I said, I learned most of what I learned as a student, K through 12, from my Jewish educational experience.
Did you ever have conversations with your father about it specifically?
Very late. Very late. First of all, because it was very hard for him to talk about. He just, wept. So it's hard to make someone you love feel that terrible pain. But our mother wanted us to know. More than his story, he wanted us to learn Hebrew, to study Torah, to know Talmud, and to be engaged as Jews. And again, I just saw that as that was the way he survived. Not to harp or bemoan, but the loss was profound. I remember in an essay I wrote that wanting to fill the gaps in his story was a very strong compulsion for me. It still is. I continue to fantasize that one day I'll just look up and see a face that looks exactly like him and say, I think we might be related. When I would speak to students, that would be how I would start. How many of you know your grandparents? Raise your hands. How many of you know your parents, sisters, and brothers? Raise your hands. I didn't. I had only my mother's family. So what we replaced for my dad, was critical. And I envied kids who had both sides of their families. I even envy other Holocaust survivors' children who have pictures and stories and memorabilia. But what it is for me now is a beautiful piece of lace that will always have holes.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, about the impact of generational trauma from the Holocaust. You can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We have a call from Don on the South Side. Good morning, Don. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm 74. Right after the Second World War, of course, there was very little talk about the Holocaust. And I was working, and I had met an old man. He was a survivor of Treblinka. And I saw the tattoo, and I asked him. And he said, if you want to know, you come and talk to me after work. So for 3 days, I sat and listened to his story. I was so moved. I made it very important to study this and to try to find out what the hell went on. I'll never have an answer, of course, why. But I understand one thing, and that is that survivors were so reluctant to talk about it. It was so painful. I get that. How does your guest feel about that aspect of it?
Thanks for the question, Don. Who wants to take that? Sam.
So I had the great privilege of getting to know quite a few survivors, some of whom I feature in my book. And it was a common theme that for many years they spoke maybe not at all or very little until their children got older. Some of them, a couple that I knew, their children had no idea that their parents were in the Holocaust at all until the children were in their 30s.
Wow.
One gentleman, when he spoke to my class, when I asked him to speak, his two children were in their 30s, and there was a hesitation on the phone when I called him. And he said, well, I guess I need to tell my kids first. They never knew. They just knew he was an immigrant from Poland. And because it was so horrific. But in starting in the 1980s, but even more so in the 1990s, as these survivors began to age, they began to share these stories with their children, but also to speak to schools and churches and synagogues, because they realized that the world needed to know and the next generation needed to know.
But I think to Don's point, you're drawing out really painful stories, really painful histories. How do you balance the feelings and the reactions of the people that you're interviewing with your need to get that important information?
To make these stories personal, and that these experiences, however horrific and painful, truly did happen, but they also, these people survived, and like, you know, here our other guests, they had children and grandchildren, and the Nazis were not successful. Their goal was to make the European Jews an extinct group of people. And they tried very hard, but they were not successful. And we now have survivors with children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that are flourishing. And I want to tell those stories as well, that they're stories of hope and resilience and joy and living flourishing lives here in the United States as well as other places in the world.
Add to that. I did a 120-hour course at Yad Vashem, which is Israel's Museum of Holocaust Memorial. And I had a professor there whose father never spoke of his experience. He became an analyst, not surprisingly, and his studies showed that a lot of survivors wouldn't speak of their experiences or tell their stories until they'd had grandchildren. And that was somehow a psychological freedom. Now I'm safe. Now I can speak. My father passed away before he knew grandchildren, but I believe that that is... he didn't want his legacy to be his loss. He wanted his legacy to be what he represented in life. I had another professor there who said, please don't teach Holocaust and make people morbidly fascinated with the way they died. Mm-hmm. Celebrate their lives.
That's a very good point. Why do you think it is, Sam, that your mother, Ella, became comfortable later in life talking about something that she had for so long held inside?
I think she realized, as Sam had mentioned, that it was time to tell the story. The world needs to know. What you see on TV and heard on the news was nothing compared to what the real atrocities were, and that story needed to get out. And at that point, she started, speaking to the schools and anybody that wanted to hear her story. My father didn't. I mean, you'd ask him a question, he would answer it for you, but he wasn't prolific speaker as my mom was, and he never told his story to the public, but my mom felt it was time.
Did it change your mother in any way that you saw being able to talk about that, kind of confronting that terrible period in her life?
Yes, I think that seeing the children engaged, the children would send her thank you letters and saying how it made such a difference in their lives, and even when she started to speak through the course of time and she'd see these kids, as they would mature and be adults in society, they would come up to her and remember her and tell her story. And she was very, very pleased by seeing that.
So this, Sam Cox, your book just published formally at the beginning of this month. And as you said, you didn't anticipate how the world would change from the time that you began this work to today. It has changed. How does that impact either how your book is being discussed or how it's being received or how you're presenting on it when you are doing book signings here and elsewhere?
Sure. I began the research and the writing several years ago, again, not anticipating the climate in today's world. And it's just indicative of how necessary it is to tell these stories. And the book is being well received. I think there's a heightened awareness because of this is local history in Jacksonville and the First Coast. Broader implications because of the Holocaust, but in today's climate, even more significant implications. And so many people realizing, we need to be more aware and we need to spread the word to family and friends so that the world must know, because this is in a different way, but repeating the past.
And in terms of repeating the past, this story is a common story, and yet this is told around Jacksonville as this, locus that everybody shared. Was Jacksonville different at the time that people were coming and this community was growing of people who were, having survived what they'd survived landing in Jacksonville?
You know, I... People ended up in Jacksonville for different reasons and at different times. Some came directly, you know, after the liberation. You know, they might spend a few years in a DP camp in Europe and then come to Jacksonville in the early 50s. You know, others, like the Rogozinskis, spent some time in Israel and then came a little bit later. A couple others that I knew retired here when they had children that might have gotten jobs here. So they came here in the 80s or early 90s. For the most part, Jacksonville warmly welcomed and received them, although there were times in the 50s and early 60s where they experienced anti-Semitism here in Jacksonville. And I think it was your parents.
My mom, yeah.
Yeah, and had an apartment that when they first came here, briefly stayed and had to leave after a couple of weeks.
Exactly. They weren't well received. And I remember at one of her places that she worked at one point, there was an employee there that just was anti-Semitic and just totally gave her a hard time constantly.
And when you say weren't well received, can you be more specific about what it was that they encountered?
Yeah, the apartment we were living at the time, they found out, I guess, after the fact that we were Jews, and we just made it so uncomfortable we had to leave.
Do you remember anything of that? Were you too young?
I was pretty young at that point.
How about your siblings?
I don't remember the exact details, but I just remember, you know, having heard that story.
Mm-hmm. After your mom started talking publicly about her experiences, did you and your siblings begin discussing it amongst yourselves at all?
We always did. I think we've always had that sense of guilt. And obviously, we were a very close family, and the three of us spent so much time together that we do talk a lot about our stories from home and growing up, and we do speak about it frequently, or remembering a story that she had maybe told one but didn't tell the other, and we kind of put our stories together to try to piece it together.
And how about with your own children? Is this the kind of thing that you discussed? Did you leave it up to Ella?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely discussed. It was very important for our children. Even today, my middle daughter has a website where she commemorates and makes Holocaust remembrance jewelry. She wants to continue to honor her grandparents and
what it's named after.
Yeah, it's named after my mom and dad, Jacob, J-A-K-O-B, Ella, E-L-L-A, Jacob Ella, and in honor of them, that she continues to keep the story going.
And I saw she makes some necklaces imprinted with your grandmother's number.
Or any Holocaust survivor's number, but I have one that has my dad's prison number and my mom's tattoo number, yes.
Sam, tell us about a little bit more about these book signings that are coming up. So people, if they're interested in buying this book, I will give them an everlasting name, where they can find it and where they can talk to you.
This weekend on Saturday, I will be at San Marco Books and More from 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. With book signings. And then Sunday, June the 2nd, from 2 p.m. till 4:30 p.m., I'll be doing a book talk and book signing at Happy Medium Books. And I will have books available. And it's also available, can be ordered at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, actually hundreds of booksellers around the world that it can be purchased online. There are a few bricks and mortar stores that are beginning to carry it. I'm told that a couple of the Barnes and Nobles here in town are carrying it.
I'm sure they will, an important history of Jacksonville. Thanks so much for coming on to talk about it. Sam Cox, appreciate it. And good luck this weekend with your book signings.
Thank you.
Sam Rogozinski, thanks for talking about your parents' experience and your family. And Naomi, thank you so much for being here as well. Really appreciate it.
Welcome.
Okay. Up next, author and historian Wayne Wood schools us on how the city narrowly saved the mid-century masterpiece of the Hayden Burns Library.
Walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzzing the leaves beneath my feet.
Welcome back. The mid-century masterpiece at the corner of Adams and Ocean Streets downtown is no longer a library, but it's still called the Hayden Burns Library, And probably no one in Jacksonville knows more about it than my guest, author and architectural historian, Dr. Wayne Wood. Wayne, how would you describe this building for somebody who's never seen it?
The Hayden Burns Library is Jacksonville's mid-century modern masterpiece. It is over a half a block coverage. It is the premier downtown mid-century building. But it's quirky, and I guess if you had to apply any adjective to it, it is that. It is covered on three sides with these amazing angular wings, fins that were popular on cars and such back in the 1960s. The building was built in 1965, and it was designed by architect Taylor Hardwick, who was one of Jacksonville's premier architects in the 60s, and who went on to build many, many other great mid-century modern gems in Jacksonville. But this building stands alone as the masterpiece of Taylor Hardwick's career. Now, the interesting thing is, as much as we revere this building today, at one point it was widely desired to tear it down because it was so quirky and ugly. And I don't think it was ugly, but
it wasn't
people
that long
that.
Ago either.
Yes, and so if you look at the layers of history, originally on that same site in 1902. Clutho built the City Hall, the great architect Clutho, and it was the grand masterpiece of Jacksonville architecture at the time. After 50 years, it had become out of style, passé, that old classical building with a dome on it. And so they tore it down and built the glistening modern Hayden Burns Library. And then 50 years after it was built, again, the fashions changed and people wanted to tear it down. An 18-story condominium was destined to be built on the site of what is now the DuPont Center, which is the Hayden Burns Library.
So, sometimes called the Jesse these days, right? The Jesse.
They nickname it the Jesse, but it was amazingly at the last minute before the building was about to be torn down. It was purchased and later on put under the custody of the DuPont Fund, which lovingly restored it. And although it is no longer a library, the wonderful features of it that made it so attractive and keeps it attractive today is they retained all the beautiful colors, the murals, the fins, the very abstract design of the facade of this building.
Because there is this elaborate tile work inside and outside.
Local artist Ann Williams was the artist who designed these amazing glazed tile mosaics that are both on the inside and the outside of the building that add to its playfulness, to its modern, super modern image of that time, and add a colorful oasis in the middle of an otherwise bland downtown when this building was built. And I dare say, 100 years from now, when architectural historians come to Jacksonville, they will want to see four buildings. One will be the Gulf Life Tower, another will be the Chart House, another will be the St. James Building, and of course, they'll want to see the Hayden Burns Library.
It is amazing that it was saved because it was very close. There wasn't a lot of appetite for saving it. As you say, people thought it was old-fashioned, tired, kind of very, you know, looked of the past. But it's ironic that the person that was initially talking about building a condominium on that site is now the steward of three of the most historic buildings in downtown Jacksonville, the Laura Street Trio.
Steve Adkins and I have had many conversations about that and his conversion from being on the verge of tearing down one of our greatest buildings. And he's now the steward of the Laura Street Trio, three of our most precious historic buildings downtown. And hopefully we'll soon see progress on restoring those three buildings as among the most important historic buildings in downtown Jacksonville.
And Taylor Hardwick, the architect of the library building, also designed Friendship Fountain, although it's kind of a shadow of what he originally designed in terms
exactly.
of the space. But he also liked to incorporate architectural elements that fed into or fed off of the Florida environment in terms of light but also kind of shadow that made it not so hot. He really was an advanced designer, and this building really encapsulates some of that.
Well, he was, as you say, a genius at design and the interplay of light and shadow. Color was one of his big themes. But also, he loved to experiment with modern materials. Concrete blocks at that time were a fairly new innovation in homes especially. And he designed buildings where concrete became actually part of the decoration of the building as well as the structure of it. Sadly, he's gone now, but he was a great friend and one of Jacksonville's great architects after World War II.
Do you think that there's a lesson that we could take, especially given that there was this other building on that site that was by a renowned architect that was in its time also just thought to be incredible and beautiful, only to be replaced by this library, which nearly lost its life? First of all, are we getting beyond that sort of cyclical identity where we, you know, want to tear down and rebuild without appreciating history?
If you look at downtown and the hundreds of buildings that have been torn down, downtown is our greatest architectural crucible. After the fire, all those hundreds of new buildings were built. When I wrote the first copy of Jacksonville's Architectural Heritage in 1987, in the 12 years it took to write that book, 20% of the buildings got torn down. Take Riverside. In the night after the Great Fire, many people moved to Riverside and built great mansions that was the showplace of Jacksonville. 50 years later, they were out of style. They were too big for people to live in, so they got torn down. So after 50 years after the start of Riverside Avondale Preservation, I challenge people to say, don't take it for granted that these buildings will survive forever, because 50 years from now, they may be passe and out of style. Once again, people don't want to live in those old buildings. So we must keep our resolve to appreciate our city's architecture as works of art that are worth cherishing and saving and passing on to future generations.
Are there any particular areas or styles of architecture right now that you think are vulnerable to that sense of let's just get rid of it and move on?
Well, not every building should be saved just because it's old, but we're now coming to appreciate two things. One, there are a lot of buildings that were not necessarily architectural landmarks when they were built, but because of their cultural history, many of them for example, in historic East Side, there's a little bungalow there you drive by 100 times and never look at until you realize that was the home where Zora Neale Hurston lived. And so sometimes the cultural heritage is just as important as the architectural heritage of a building. And we need to seek out and find those buildings that are relative to our historic past so that we can pass them on to future generations and be able to explain them to future generations.
Well, Dr. Wayne Wood, author of Jacksonville's Architectural Heritage and historian, thank you so much for being here, as you have been, to catch us up on a little bit of Jacksonville history.
Thank you, Anne. It's always a pleasure.
And we'll be right back.
Buried underneath is the sexiest library. Take off those glasses and let down your hair for me. So I watch you through the bookcase, imagining a scene. You and I at dinner, spending time, then to sleep. And what then would I say to you, lying there in bed? These words with a kiss I would plant in your head. What is it inside our heads that makes us do the opposite? Makes us do the opposite of what's right.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
20 minutes of reading a day paves the way to success, and we can make reading a game. Read game instructions together or go on letter scavenger hunts throughout the day. Remember, it all adds up to 20 minutes.
For more information, readjax.org.
4 years ago, Oregon became the first state in the nation to decriminalize small amounts of hard drugs. But last month, the state repealed it.
Oregonians have been clear. They are ready for this misguided drug decriminalization experiment to be over.
A postmortem on Oregon's drug decriminalization efforts. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Yo-Yo Ma, the most revered cellist in America. He'll talk about his life as a musician, starting with learning a Bach cello suite when he was 4. And he'll play some pieces on his cello, Petunia, including what he plays at memorials and commemorations, and what he loves to play for himself. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Where did the fight for same-sex marriage begin, and where does it stand today? Next time on 1A, we look back on 20 years of same-sex marriage and how attitudes have changed around it, as well as how that historic win in Massachusetts paved the way for LGBTQ plus rights across the country.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. So just how out of space, how far is outer space? Nobody better to answer than our resident spaceman, Eddie Whistler.
Oh, there's better people.
No. Well, not here in this studio
at
this
today,
moment.
Probably.
Eddie Whistler, of course, is director of the Brian Gooding Planetarium at the Museum of Science and History. He joins us once a month to help us understand this greater space around us. Today we're talking about distances in space.
Yeah, distances of space. Hopefully we can start close and get ourselves out to the observable universe. But you know, you and I, we always take tangents and we wind up wherever we wind up.
So wherever we wind up. But it is hard for people to visualize space. It's such an kind of incomprehensible size for the human brain, mine particularly. So tell us how we misunderstand, we misapprehend how far things are apart.
Well, so, you know, thinking about the topic that we might talk about today, I was reminded of some questions that I had by some students that were coming into the planetarium just a couple days ago, and also that there were just recent launches that were going out into, quote, space, right? So, classroom globe, size of the Earth. A lot of people imagine that, like, the International Space Station is somewhere, you know, a significant distance off the surface, but the thickness, not the length of your pinky, but the thickness of your pinky is the height at which the altitude that the International Space Station is orbiting around the Earth.
Were the Earth the size of a classroom globe?
Yes.
The International Space Station would be a pinky's width.
Yes.
Away from the Earth. So
So
not that far in
That's where we regular, right? That's where we go. That's where humans are. And so, you know, we're not way out there in space by any measure. On that same scale, the moon would be probably around 35 or 40 feet away.
Wow, so much further.
So much further.
And what size would it be?
About the size of a baseball. Roughly, you know, classroom globes, everybody has their own conception of what it is, but, you know, more or less, these are the distances that we're talking about.
So that's extraordinary. It would be 40 feet away.
Yeah. And now that's just the nearby stuff. Like, it really gets mind blowing when we start thinking about the distances between stars, which is what I brought for you. I brought you a gift.
Oh, so what's this?
That is a little sand grain.
Okay.
I brought her a little white sand grain that is right around a millimeter, and I put it on my black canvas, what is this thing?
Briefcase kind
of
thing.
Like briefcase.
Trapper keeper, we call it.
Yeah, and this little white 1 millimeter sand grain really sticks out in my trapper keeper. Wow, look at you. High five for that one.
Old school.
And so, you know, now let's imagine that the sun is the size of this thing right here. So 1 millimeter.
Okay.
First off, the sun can contain, let's say, a million Earths. If the sun was a planet piggy bank into which you could deposit planets, you go ahead and deposit around 1 million Earths inside of the sun. So the sun is enormous compared to the Earth that we were just contemplating.
But here it's this tiny grain.
But now the sun is, you know, down to the scale of this tiny grain. If you had to guess, what would be the distance to the next millimeter sand grain, our next nearest star to us?
Next nearest star to the sun?
To the sun. When the sun is the size of this 1 millimeter, we're scaling down space, we're scaling down the sun.
I would say, you know, within a pinky's width.
Okay. If we were to scale down the sun to the size of 1 millimeter, and I challenge viewers or listeners, I should say, if you have a ruler nearby, go remind yourself how small 1 millimeter is. So look at, you know, the metric side and, the next closest millimeter grain sand would be 18 miles away.
Wow.
So that's maintaining the scale, not just of the sun, but the space between the stars as well. So our sun is a sand grain, 1 millimeter in diameter, which is kind of, you know, admittedly, it's kind of a big sand grain.
Yeah.
As far as sand grains go.
Sure.
But the next nearest sand grain, the next nearest star on that scale is 18 miles away.
I love when you just make my head explode on this show, Eddie. It's really a great experience.
It's fun. And now there's 250 billion of these sand grains in our galaxy, and galaxies collide. And so when galaxies collide, the space between the stars is so far that there's really no collision of stars. The galaxy is more like merge, like ghosts that would join and bring all of the stars together to make bigger galaxies. And we see this happening out there in space as well.
This is something that you are available to talk about at the planetarium all the time. You've got some summer stuff going.
All the time. We have summer. We're talking, so we do a series called Planetarium Night Live. And in June, there's one. And we'll be talking about 700 days of James Webb Space Telescope. Oh. So that's coming up in June.
Good stuff.
You know, pretty much a month from now, June 21st, as a matter of fact.
I appreciate you coming in and helping us scale down the universe to a digestible discussion.
Yeah.
Great to see you, Eddie.
Have a good one.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And that's our program. Join us tomorrow when we talk to parents fighting plans to close some 30 Duval County schools. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.